Kevin's poems have appeared in Poetry, Plowshares, The Southern Review, The Antioch Review, Chicago Review, Gulf Coast, Shenandoah, Streetlight, and many others. He's originally from the Cleveland area, and he studied at Glasgow University, received his BA from Miami University in Literature and Creative Writing, and was a Henry Hoynes Fellow in the University of Virginia's MFA program. At UVA, he was a poetry editor for Meridian and was a finalist in the 1999 Ruth Lilly Fellowship sponsored by Poetry Magazine. Associate Program Director for the Virginia Festival of the Books. He lives in Charlottesville with his wife, Angie Hogan. We're very honored. Thank you.
Thank you very much. It's an honor to read aloud in public, and I thank you for that. Last time I think I read was about 2 years ago in Charlottesville, so it doesn't happen often. I'm very grateful for the opportunity.
Hope it happens more often.
And the festival definitely benefits from people like Susan, Juliet, and Sharon putting together programs and keeping festival going all year here in town. I'm going to read some poems. It's funny how you just select, Rose and I hadn't met before, but you select some things and find out, these are going to work really well together. The first one I'm going to read today is a poem about my mother and written for my mother. We're in a school here. She was a teacher herself, and as one of the people that taught me the language I know. Interestingly, and not a lot of people know this about her or me, is that she wasn't born in this country. She was born in Hungary. And to talk to her, you might not even know yourself. So it was kind of a process of rediscovering my mother as an immigrant that went on that led me to this poem. I mention in it how names can get changed when people move to a new country. And my mother's family's name was changed. It wasn't changed in their American passage, but on a clerical mistake on a baptismal certificate. Her name changed from Pretmirsky to Bretmirsky. It's just one letter. But it's always kind of fascinated me how life might have been different just because of these things. We really get classified and are at the head of the room in a school because of our names, or get chosen for jury duty, or any number of things that could happen for these seemingly random changes. Anyway, that'll come up tangentially in here, but maybe even more later. It's called A French Statue for my mother. Liberty's so high up, you think. You expected her down to earth. No such luck. You clasp at your mother's skirt. She knows this place where names get changed, some by accident, some not, where immigrants learn a new sir, or as you'll see here, a last. You're next. Your name, your next of kin. Next, you'll learn is how to move lines, not cues, no matter what that kind Irish passenger taught you. Next, please. Next. And this is the city you heard of but a year ago, as your parents explained in Hungarian. Soon enough, you'll be in school. They'll ask what you speak, and mudjor, you'll repeat. Mud, your, a tongue pronounced with mud. Hungary, you'll learn for its own pun by first Thanksgiving. Turkey, you will learn to stuff. More and more each year, you'll grow to love the Salvation Army Santa, ringing bells to bring Christmas. You'll give me coins to feed his kettle and say these people were your first taste of America. Sugar cookies, weak cocoa, Willkommen, what the lady said to you, so strangely, with a will. Those first few crumbs of welcome, have some. Or is it bienvenue? Neither, thank you. You're welcome now. Hard to tell you from a local. Hard to tell you, too, what I've clung to. Phrases you fed. American as mom and apple pie. Brand spanking new. Chew the fat. Take a load off. Each a measure of freedom. The drinking gourd. 40 acres and a mule. A chicken in every pot. A man on the moon. And odd numerologies of urgency. Second wind. Fourth quarter. The bottom of the ninth. At contradictions, we never stopped. Free rain. Statue of Liberty. How you made me take it all with displaced patience, just in case, any way the wind blows, you never know. In the meantime, make yourself at home. All systems go. I'm going to read a few that are, they use place names in them as their titles. Often they're meditations that go beyond the place, although it may start there. Sometimes it doesn't even start there. There are Ohio place names, Roots Town, Glasgow, Ohio, Circleville, Ohio. And on the Glasgow note, it actually does refer to Scotland, as Juliet said, that's where I was for a year. And Circleville, when it comes up, is a town in Ohio that had Hopewell Mounds that were two circles. And actually, it had those. They were removed, and the poem is about that. Promise, Roots Town. I'll tell you what you need to know about me. I never slept on any Parnassan ledges. Place names were always better than the places. And somewhere, under that gunmetal sky of childhood, one I loved died in my arms. That's it. Anything else is embellishment. I'll tell you what you need to know about me. We won't be helped by swapping hard knocks. Aside, I've lain that my paw can lick your paw urge to say my pain can lick your pain. I'll tell you what. Instead, from your far city, look around you. It's all right there. The roots of longing and despair in any order of cities. We have this between us. I'll tell you what you need to know about me. Lone, Glasgow. Where I first learned to say things, Ohio, my accent was the local legal tender, good in Edinburgh as Dublin or London. Then came Glasgow proper. 1 year abroad in broad Glaswegian, the notes brought from home bouncing everywhere, overdrawn. Want a wild time? In Glasgow, time was tame. See the town? You had to hear the tune. New loans, including my name, I began saying cave-in if I wanted the right introduction in a pub. The road was rude. The power sometimes poor. My voice skim milk in that butter churn of gutturals, Scots vowels clotted and spread like cream. I learned to hear everything twice and nothing the same. Glasgow never leaves you alone. It leaves you a lane. And this is Erosion, Circleville. A boulder shows how nature fights the right angle, tenderness toward every edge, for every sharp, a correspondent soothe. The sagged stone stair worn of waiting. Corners take the block nowhere. It wants to wheel in any direction, go rolling. You there. You turning curves into squares, try Rome and its hills. Try Cincinnati. Or try Circleville, the burg you've never heard of. Try the prehistoric mounds it settled in. A circular town looked so good on paper. Folks came to see, with steam. But the avenues proved difficult for carriages, for commerce. Arc by arc, old earth walls removed, the circular squarely voted down. today no vestige left, like anyone can resist an edge, like any other town. That'd be great. Thank you.
Okay. Yes.
Thank you. I'm going to read a poem that I put together with some quotes from Tacitus, the Roman historian. I keep getting told it sounds a lot like today. It probably was intended on the front end. They always talk about the shows on TV being ripped from the headlines. This might be ripped from the headlines of 70 AD or so, something like that. Ad tacitum. And I'll say before I begin that there's a bunch of citations of where these are from along with this poem, and I'm not trying to hide the fact that it's really spliced together. It's not something you're going to read and find in this order. That might be enough. Ad tacitum. To relate a few facts without bitterness or partiality. I can hardly venture any positive statement about the high elections. In every precedent, there is some injustice. The renown of the name drew the ignorant. Of all things human, the most precarious and passing is a reputation for power. Indolence raised him to fame, as industry raises others. Theft, slaughter, and plunder, they gave the false name of empire. Such the lesson he takes from his father's counsels. His words escaped him with a seeming struggle. Such is the training of the future ruler of the world, the first emperor who needed another man's eloquence. He had the old inbred family arrogance. Sensible men, however, spoke variously of his deeds with praise and censure. The daring wickedness by which he made plays for power, wishing to have had the credit of being called and elected by the state rather than slinking into power through intrigues. It was portended there were to be political changes for the worse. Then came a violent shock as the building fell inwards. As the panic spread, the weak were trodden down in the bustle and confusion. Even brave men are scared of sudden terrors. The disaster was not forgotten when a furious fire damaged the Capitol. This was at the beginning of a grinding and unmitigated despotism. The emperor, who seldom went out and holed himself up in his house and gardens, used to adjourn for the entertainments of the circus. He enjoyed the wrangles of opposing dogmatists. He concentrated in himself the functions of the Senate, the magistrates, and the laws. We must punish the perpetrators of atrocious acts. Every circumstance was scrutinized and exaggerated. The nobles were disgracing themselves on public stages, pretending to be orators and poets. Terror at home had filled their hearts. The checkbook of empire, he said, can only be balanced by one person. All this is full of doubt and legendary hyperbole. How ready these men are to be slaves. Let them go back to their usual pursuits. Better, he held, to undermine the Constitution than depose its guardians. He was heard in silence, or with but a slight murmur. Now they threw off the reins, so to speak, and loosed their fury. They sought a remedy in war. All this, however, was related with exaggeration to the Senate. Lust for dominion is the most flagrant of the passions. There was then a deafening cheer. He had revived the law of treason. This, though it promoted justice, ruined liberty. They applied their ears to cracks and crevices. It was, they said, a great opportunity for the recovery of freedom. This was spoken openly. Other words were whispered. All this the emperor regarded as subverting his own power, granted that he had his purpose. Speech was restricted and perilous, so corrupted indeed and debased was that time by sycophancy. Over all hung a terror. Thereafter followed a scarcity of money. In his grief he discovered one source of relief in war. It was then resolved to delay no more. Uproar, wounds, bloodshed were everywhere visible. Go forward, he said, and hurry your guilt into glory. From 9 a.m. to night, the enemy were slaughtered. Half-armed stragglers were cut down without bloodshed to our side. They make a wasteland, and they call it peace. There was a hardness and general arrogance in public. All good folk were saddened by anxiety for the country. Only the insignificant and unimportant were punished. Having crossed the Tigris, they roamed over the country, now began a series of engagements, for the most part raids, deciding that they should die by the just doom of war. Encounters due to chance or courage, carelessness or calculation, under orders of officers, or at times without their knowledge, having harried by fire and sword all whom he thought were against us. He was incessantly attacked by that tribe skilled in guerrilla warfare. The miserable have more vehemence and greater resolve. And now they went on to further murders, less than us in military might, but equal in a war of surprises. Then followed two decades of continuous strife. Next came a religious question. None were to fall out of line. There were other interrogations of the same sort, inane and idle. Then, as usual in lovers' spats, harsh words, oaths, reproaches, and excuses. That same year, 12 famous cities across Asia fell by an earthquake. A horrific disaster was sustained in Britain. A year of shame and so many evil deeds, heaven also marked by hurricanes and pestilence. The emperor kept our losses a secret. Meanwhile, the scuffle in the East was rather pleasing. Peace had become as much dreaded as war. But heaven is on the side of a righteous revenge. The gods favor the stronger. I have often heard him say that a single legion and a few auxiliaries could take and occupy Ireland. Even war is a good trade for a wretched peace. Meantime, the law of treason was gaining momentum. It was a tough and, so to speak, macho despotism. A leader properly leads by forethought, by counsel, and by delay more than temerity. These and similar arguments failed to sway the emperor. The emperor's advisors indeed shuddered. How few remained who had seen the republic. Little joy interrupted this long litany of horrors. He had now had enough of success and disaster. Rigor at the outset becoming negligence at the end. He fell back on those idle and oft-ridiculed promises of restoring the republic. Public opinion is not always mistaken. Abundant and more than abundant blunders, they said. You must not check vices abroad without recalling the scandals of the capital. We should have lost memories as we lost our voices, where it is easy to forget as to keep silent. I do but record what I have heard. While we're on the classical note, or semi-classical, I was going to read a couple of poems, change tone, but maybe be calling on Greek mythology here to the story of Narcissus and Echo. Two poems. The first will be in Narcissus's voice, the second in Echo's. Scum rises, Narcissus. The cream always floats to the top. So does the scum. So does comparison. Up from what's mere muck, mire metaphor would flower out of, and so on with the similes, and so on with the show, and so on. I'm ever looking down on you, and you are ever lying. My love is proof of truth's angle of refraction. You are lost in slant ration, and I am fond of posing postulations. A mendacity needn't be truthless, for example. You there, in the pond, appearing peered at, come up and see me sometime. Let's delve for the above. When will we ever get over ourselves? At Amen, Echo. A mendacity needn't be truthless, you said. I hung on your words in those days. Oh, the wounds I heard inside your swoons, the lays I laid around your blaze. I admit your intentions were more than half my inventions. Not love, some other empire. The early attentions and the late attenuations. But I wanted a lover, not my abettor, a better. The awfully big house of your little light wise, I think of you now and then. A mendacity needn't be truthless. If you ever lost me at ruthless, you had me at amen. And it's strange to think in mythological terms sometimes. You don't always know what's the sort of reservoir of memory for a myth that you have to draw on, especially Greek myth, maybe not as much taught anymore, and different sort of mythologies coming along as well and entering our consciousness. And it makes you think actually about our own mythologies and kind of who's going to be our Edith Hamilton for our day to the things that we could talk about in reference in everyday conversation that will mean absolutely nothing to someone 2,000 years from now. I think about it once in a while. And I also think about people like Joyce, who would sometimes intentionally frustrate the scholars and translators by making particularly hard references. So thinking about what our world or the things we're used to, brand names maybe especially in this poem, because they are a kind of mythology that we know and know what things mean. This is thinking about that. There'll be some footnotes at the end on that note. And you'll hear numbers pop up then, that's what those will be. A used car. Track teams door to door hawking Redenbachers. The neighbors' new olds, your old news on the stoop, the Joneses who need keeping up with, the Nielsens who watch for us, watching. These families we speak of, today we all know who means what. But tell those Kaufman kids we gave at the office, who'll know what we meant in 1,000 years, our spell to fend off vendors. Why leave posterity anything? It's holding back from us. I mean to take some flavors out of this world. It'll give the translators something to suck on. One, McDonald's, a carnivorous clan name renowned for building arches. Two, Smuckers, a brand, if lost to history, known to rhyme. Royal families, oil families, that Rockefeller fella, names generations live with or up to. Let coming soon read the labels, maybe window shop at Macy's, or the esoteric Peterson's 3 Auto Oasis. The future's discerning. Afford it a Ford or two for every what's an Edsel. That'll learn it. And I'll just read a couple more. But back on the topic of switching letters around, there's a type of poem I've been doing for some years now. I just call it an anagram poem, where you have a line of text and you break the line apart, almost as if every letter were a block. Every other line gets remade of the blocks that are in that first one. Archipelago was very kind in the early years when I was doing these to publish some. Thank you, Catherine. She's in the audience today. I stumbled on a quote by Alexis de Tocqueville, the 19th century French writer who wrote so much about democracy in America, the early democracy. And it was just one of those quotes that I thought, this is one to get. He said, I can see the entire destiny of America contained in the first Puritan who came ashore. So I thought I'd try it with the first Puritan who came ashore. The first Puritan who came ashore trips. He's a Noah, Mr. White-faced tourist. He hurries a footpath, crewman to his craft. He pours water in. Ahem. Amen. Ah, the outset wraps horrific, warps horrific, to mute heathen as he shoots them criteria. A pawn, fur carrier. He's white out of phantasm. He's white out of an archer's armpit. He's a Scorpio, a turf man, there with photos, Africa's hue. Anthem writer, He can eat his firearms to throw up. Oh, his fences are without rampart, for now. His pure, trite tea has machines to warm it, fresh. A hut poacher, his supreme wit, a thatch roof near matches, he waits for open-air hurt to come. He rips with nature, has far hopes, humor. A fate is written, char-proof. A heartache is written, hums a patriarch, whose form is the tune, wipe out. He's a harmonist, hair fact, Monsieur Wasp. Oh, faith chatterer, a horror, in fact. He imports the USA, true whim. Catastrophe fashioner, he ushers in a camera, how Fort Pitt was won. Art, triumph, he aches for it. Hiroshima, statecraft, whereupon war's a first pitch, a hereunto home. He is written of, our hatcher, a maps craftsman, a pious hero there with a trump or two in his feathers, each sort of new at rapture, his hymn, each one apart, few hum. History's chart after his hurt. He's an atomic power. And this is the last I'll read. I don't have a book of poems. I have a lot of sheaves of them. And I've come to the realization that just visualization of a book is the answer. If I just keep thinking about it and keep talking about it, one day it will appear. And on that note, I decided to write an envoy poem. It's the kind of poem where it's one poem that tells all the poems to get in line and become a book and march off and do good in the world. And trying to write that kind of a poem, it's also ended up as a sort of rain dance for writer's block and strangely a prayer. It's very mixed up and it has a lot of these sort of letters popping in and dropping out. I'll read it slowly. You might have to think of it in terms of the letters at some times, especially L's and R's, which are getting sort of manically reversed as it goes on. It's called Ite. Go, my interactions, with enough muck about. Seek new illigation, another rake and lake. The light has not lain, the rain's not right. Fresh of my flesh, flock of my frock, we fade to wet. Ask, fade to bask, to be set on fire, not on file. Arrayed, not allayed. Flee this rand. Go revel and lever in the one-off world. What lows they may take from these rows. Fade to stake. Fade to crows. Cannot tell my else from my arse. And the fish pod is correcting nothing. Cloud, fade to clod. Dry, fade to day. Crown of my clown, crutch of my clutch, may they lead you. Glow, grow, be kindled, be kindred. Oh, fade to go. Go, fade to God. Offer a player a prayer. See that I'm not collected ahead of my time. Thank you.
Yeah. So, excuse me. That was wonderful. Thank you, Gavin.